Well, we have a good idea from the sharing of joys and concerns about April being the cruelest month. And somehow it seems harder to take in April when we are afflicted with all of life. Former birthright Unitarian Universalist poet T.S. Eliot, who left the Unitarian faith, and effectively all of those Eliots who had been famous Unitarians, including presidents of the denomination, left St. Louis and went to England and wrote some great poetry. And probably The Wasteland is the most important poem of the 20th century, and its opening lines, "April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs from dead earth, mixing memory with desire." Probably the most famous opening lines of 20th century poetry. Maybe I've seen the best minds of my generation gone mad from Allen Ginsberg's Howl. Being 50 years newer is better known to this generation. But they're important words in an important poem that resonates with an awful lot of people. And I have to tell you that as a minor, I didn't really have much insight into the poem, you'll be happy to know. And so for the lit majors, you can correct me when I'm done. Because I'm not talking about the poem as much as April, this being at the end of April. And what does it mean that April is the cruelest month? I mean, it's spring. It's the time of life, of desire, of rebirth, of all kinds of vital sexual energy pulsing through humans and animals and nature, and it should be a time of joy. Why is April the cruelest month? Could it be because it's tax season? And April 15th, death and taxes? Could it be because we're having our canvass in April? No, that's not the reason. Why April? I didn't really begin to understand it until 1975, and I was driving along listening to the Dodger game. This happens to be a true story and a factual story. And Vin Scully is doing the Dodger game, as he has done for 54 years, and he said, "Well, you know, this is April 1975. You know, as the poet said, and the poet said it best, April is the cruelest month, mixing memory with desire. And here is Juan Marichal with former greatness and the memory of his greatness, and looking forward at the springtime with the desire to continue his career with the Dodgers." I almost drove off the road. I mean, here is a sports announcer doing T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland seamlessly and unpretentiously. And it was actually far beyond the insights conveyed, or at least that I was paying attention to from my various lit professors. It actually opened up the sense of memory and hope, and how we look forward with all kinds of expectations, particularly in the springtime. And we look backwards from where we have been, and there should be this wonderful sense of relief because it's spring. We've made it alive, more or less, to the next season. But the problem with human beings is we think in time, and that's also the wonderful part of human beings. We can see over the horizon of spring to summer, to fall, to winter. We know where we've been, and spring with all its joy doesn't really make us forget where we're going and that cycle of life and that cycle of mortality. I know that January is the month where you're supposed to, it's named after the two-faced god Janus, where you look forward and look backward, but I really think it's April. When Moby Dick, Moby Dick was written by, Melville, thank you. Minimal cognitive impairment. Okay, it's what it is, MCI. It's not a recommendation for your long-distance carrier. It's a diagnosis. Melville wrote that, and we can all recognize this, when it is November in my soul. You're supposed to feel kind of miserable in November. Winter's coming, it's raining, things are falling off of the trees, and the arthritis starts to kick in, and it's November. But April, you just feel guilty feeling lousy in April. You know, the sky's blue. How can I have the blues if the sky's blue? How can I be worried about my mortality? How can I be worried about the lethality of life? Now, I had another strange epiphany on that subject from a song, which I will get to. When I was young, I knew about death. I knew you could die. I loved Saroyan's line. Where Saroyan lay dying, he said, "I knew death was inevitable, but I thought it would make an exception for me." I knew you could die. I mean, I hitchhiked as a young person. I got picked up by Richard Boone, you remember, from Paladin, in his AC Ace. There's at least one person here who knows what an AC Ace is, Ron. I got picked up by the other Jim Garner, the less famous one than ours, in his black Corvette. And there's nothing like a four-wheel drift on Sunset Boulevard to bring one face-to-face with a sense of imminent demise. I had been frightened as a youth. I have to say, jumping out of an airplane at 8,000 feet to impress Ruthie Rosenshine wasn't the most intelligent thing I ever did. And you do understand that falling at 120 miles an hour terminal velocity puts the terminal into terminal velocity. And I also learned from that experience that it's really hard to look macho and studly when you're covered with your breakfast. At least Ruthie Rosenshine didn't think it was that attractive. I certainly felt a sense of mortality when I was riding in a Tunisian long-distance taxi from Tunis to Gabez, and I thought that I could meet my maker at just about any moment. On the other hand, when I was on a week-long caravan on a camel across the Tunisian desert, my greatest fear was that I wasn't going to die, because camels are not built for comfort. And if you want to know why people are in such bad moods in the Middle East, go for a ride on a camel sometime, because it's a grind, and I'm going to leave it at that. I didn't really get in touch with the possibility that I could grow old until I got to Berkeley in the 60s, way before my 60s, and in the flower of my young manhood, there was this song by the Loving Spoonful that in the middle verse, it's called "Darlin' Be Home Soon," says, "And now a quarter of my life has come and gone." I was 24 years old. Given the longevity in my family, that would have made somewhere around 96, if that was going to be a quarter of my life. And I figured, I'm too old for the song. I'm too old for the people that are singing this. That it was, in a sense, that kind of epiphany, that shakti-pat, that sense of, oh my goodness, there is a natural process here. And it does not go on forever, and youth and life don't last forever. There are experiences from youth that sometimes seem like they're going to last forever. That's algebra in junior high school. But most of the good ones don't last forever. And that was really the time that I began to wrestle with the whole cyclical nature of nature, of which we are a part of, not a part from. And the idea that we are part of a world that has seasons of the sun and seasons of the soul, that we go through times when we feel, as Bill talked about, you know, might not make it, where we feel our mortality, when we see, again in Eliot's terms, the skull beneath the skin, when we have the sense, even in April as we look forward, because all of that energy of nature reminds us that it is finite, that other seasons come. One of the recurring themes that I have found in my messages is a line that I like, which is, life is an incomplete information problem. We don't know everything. And in fact, the more we think we know, probably the less secure we should be in it. Well, I've always found that people who suffered from certainty seldom suffered from wisdom. And you can see that in this season also. As a registered pundit, I can tell you, I don't know anything. When you look at the world around us and you start to make predictions, we are stuck with incomplete information. And we go from our hopes and our despairs and our certainties and our uncertainties, and it is a wild ride. Just to take, and this is not at all political and should not be construed as political, just take the primary season and everything that everybody knew at the beginning of the season. At the beginning of the season, Democrats were dancing in the streets because it was wonderful. There were two candidates that they were in love with. Then life happened. And arguments happened, and process happened, and the common wisdom of, he can't win, she's inevitable, she can't win, he's inevitable. One of the things I've learned in following peace process in the Middle East is when they say, it's gone too far now, there's no drawing back from peace. There's always drawing back from peace, and there's always drawing back from war, and there's always drawing back from inevitability. The Republicans had similar hope and despair. The Republicans said, we can't possibly win this year because there's a war and there's a bad economy and our leading candidate, who is inevitably going to get the nomination, Rudy Giuliani, is a moderate. And it's our only chance to win, but we don't like him because he's a moderate. There's a large portion of the people of color community in New York City that may not get his moderation as much as the people who feared him from the Republican establishment, but he was inevitable until he was absolutely impossible. And then the fair-haired boy, well, actually the hard-haired boy, didn't attract any attention outside of Utah. And when the prize was dropped, McCain caught it before it reached the floor because he was on the floor. He was politically dead. There is resurrection. There is coming back from political death. It's only an ephemera. Would that it were a metaphor also. And I think it probably is a metaphor also. All of the common wisdom has been unwise and inaccurate. And I say this because it's important for us to understand that we, in the middle of our lives, in the middle of political process, in the middle of our joys and our pains, we don't know exactly where we are, where we're going. We know ultimately where we're going, I suppose, but we don't know in the short run, that life doesn't give us all of the information in order to be able to predict the future. So what we have to do is we have to act with our best instincts, our best values, some good degree of modesty and humility in choosing how to be in the world. I'm going to be talking next week about ecology and all that we want and how our values and our information are sometimes in conflict with each other because life is an incomplete information problem. We human beings get to see through time. We get to see the seasons that are approaching and have to make accommodations to them. We have to understand that whether a quarter of our life has come and gone at 18 or 20 or 25, whatever has gone and whatever remains ahead, we have choices to make. And they are seldom perfect choices. We have seasons of our heart where we will, in times, even with blue skies, even in April, feel a sense of despair. A sense that it's not going the way it should. There's that wonderful line from Tom Lehrer on celebrating his 40th birthday when he said, you know, it's kind of humbling to think that when Mozart was my age, he'd been dead for 5 years. We all measure ourselves against these various standards, but life is lived in present time, in present community, in present family. We have a past to inform our decisions and our actions today. We have a future where we put our values to guide us as a beacon to take us where we want to go without certainty that we're right, without certainty that we will get there. We know that lilacs come out of dead land, that even salty tears can nourish flowers out of dead land, that when we look forward with desire, when we look back in memory, we try to find an accommodation with our lives and our values today, and without the easy and, I believe, false certainties that simple systems give us. There's no way out that I understand, that I know, without error. There's no way to live without some degree of fear and anxiety. There's no way to give our hearts to each other and our hearts to the world without those hearts being vulnerable to being hurt. There's no way to ride this merry-go-round, to ride the painted ponies up and down, without them going up and down. But we who believe in life, we who believe in this life here today, we who believe in ourselves and each other to make a better world for our children and our children's children, we believe that it's okay to be wrong, that it's okay to despair, that it's okay to cry in beautiful weather and to laugh in November. We believe, along with the Buddhist master, that in life, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And so we look to the gardens, to new life to bring us joy, to flowers to inspire us, and to be in loving company so that we can admire this world, this miracle, the colors and the tears and the laughter together. Because together is where we make life, we affirm life, we create life, and we celebrate life together.